Honestly, it costs very little, and we urge you to do that. It helps us to deliver the programs that we do. And tonight we have a return of Freeman Dyson. It was almost exactly 20 years ago this weekend that Freeman last spoke here, and probably almost like no other person, he epitomizes what the Vancouver Institute is all about. It's about ideas, and it's about really hearing fascinating ideas presented in an excellent way, with wonderful language. It's therefore also important that this lecture tonight is sponsored under the name of Belna Metz, who remains the guardian angel of the Vancouver Institute. Although her son Peter now guides the Institute, we all think that Bell would have really luxuriated in this talk tonight, because Freeman was one of her favorite people in the world. Now, Freeman Dyson really requires very little introduction. He's become, over the years, an almost a cult figure, as the audience tonight indicates. Incidentally, to those of you who are hearing this in lecture room number 6, we will bring Freeman briefly for a few questions to your room, so you can ask him some questions there and actually see him in the flesh. And then we will finish the evening in here after the lecture. Incidentally, Freeman may also spend a few minutes after the lecture if you want to get any of his many books. They're piled upstairs, and he will sign books for those people who want to have books signed. Freeman began as a remarkable young mathematician who turned to physics. After the war, when people began to pursue quantum mechanics vigorously, they were worried about this wonderful, not wonderful, terrible effect that whenever they tried to calculate anything for electricity and magnetism, they got an answer of infinity. Now, infinity is a number, but it is not a very interesting number. And people struggled with that, as did people like Schwinger and Feynman and Tominaga, who won the Nobel Prize for showing how to remove the infinities. They all had different ideas, but this young graduate student who did not yet have a PhD showed the world how those various approaches were all common. And he helped the whole physics community enormously by that. That made his mark, so that Freeman, in fact, never got his PhD. He was given a full professorship while he was still a graduate student, and I don't know of anyone else who made that leap so suddenly. And then he also moved shortly after that, where he had been appointed at Cornell, he moved to the Institute for Advanced Study, where he's now remained for about half a century. But in that half century, he's been involved in many, many projects. Some remarkable science, some technical projects. Incidentally, we're going to hear about one of his technical projects, the Starship, when his son George, who's here tonight in February, will tell us about Freeman's favorite project of 20 years ago. Those of you who have read the family book, The Starship and the Canoe, or at least a book about George and Freeman, whatever. It's now dated, but it's still an interesting book. George, we're lucky to have him here. He's also written a number of books. It runs in the family. Freeman's father was Sir George Dyson, the director of the Royal Academy of Music in London, who also made his money writing very elegant books, and also many elegant music compositions. Now, Freeman has also written many books: Disturbing the Universe, Origins of Life, The Sun, The Genome, and The Internet, Tours of Scientific Revolutions, From Eros to Gaia, Infinite in All Directions, etc., etc. Today, he will talk to us about the Davos debates. Davos is a town in Switzerland, where the World Economic Forum is held every year. It involves many of the world's economic leaders, and they come to hear the important issues of the day. And they invite leaders, intellectual leaders in their topics, to come and debate those issues. Freeman himself was invited this last January to debate with Bill Joy, founder of Sun Microsystems, on the subject of, are we in control of our technology? He had a second debate with Carl Gerasi, inventor of the birth control pill, on, is reproduction an inalienable right? And third, with Brian Greene, a physicist who thinks that he will solve all of the world's problems in a theory of everything, he was involved in the debate about when will we know it all. Now, he will tell us about those debates today, directly about those. But this span of ideas, I think, tells you the importance that Freeman has had, not only to physics and mathematics, but also to the life of the intellect. He's written many, many articles in the New Yorker, and people have developed a reverence for what he writes. He has this wonderful sense of language, which you will relish tonight as well. But above all, there are the ideas of the intellect. And you will see, perhaps, that tonight, again, we are in for a treat, which Velna Metz thought the Institute was all about, and we're so pleased that so many of you have turned out to hear this. Freeman Dyson.
Well, it's hard to live up to that advanced billing, and I think I write better than I speak, so unfortunately you'll only hear the speech and not the writing. Davos was wonderful. Davos is, of course, some of you may have read The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann, a great novel about these crazy characters who live in a sanatorium on top of the mountain in Davos. That was written 100 years ago, and the amazing thing is it hasn't really changed. In fact, my wife's nephew, in fact, is a doctor who works in the same clinic in Davos where Thomas Mann was 100 years earlier, and it's not changed much. The only difference is that rich Germans now, instead of having TB, they have asthma. So it's turned now into an asthma clinic. But the same kind of people are there, and I don't know who is writing the next novel, but you had the feeling that really nothing changes. It's a beautiful Swiss town, and because this eruption of dignitaries from all over the world happens once a year, which is a great sacrifice for the inhabitants. They're hardly able to ski because of all these people who come in, and the worst of it all was, of course, that we had to have tight security because there were threats that there would be all kinds of bad people coming up to disrupt the meetings, so that we had almost the entire Swiss army taking care of security. Well, the Swiss army, of course, is very good at that. They're tough, silent young men, and they do security very thoroughly and without any violence. So we were grateful to them, but nevertheless, it was an unfortunate interruption in the life of the town, and the operators of the local drinking houses were not too happy. But anyway, let me get on to the business. It was a name-dropper's paradise. That's, of course, the great thing about going to Davos. You can brag about all the exciting people you met. There was Ian Wilmot, the fellow who cloned Dolly, and there was Reinhold Messmer, the fellow who climbed Everest solo without oxygen, and he's now a member of the European Parliament. And so lots of wonderful people, musicians, poets, preachers, and of course the captains of industry, the tycoons, who actually run the the activity. It's basically a meeting of business people, but they invite in these extraneous characters to add a little tone to the proceedings. Well, so I was asked to debate with Bill Joy this question, is our technology out of control? That has a little bit of history. Bill Joy is the founder and chief scientist of Sun Microsystems. They're a computer company which has done wonderfully well. It's a sort of counterblast to Microsoft, and they produce beautiful computers and software to go with it. And they've maintained their independence against Microsoft, and it's a company I respect. And so Bill Joy has spent his life developing this technology, and I think has a very enlightened view of it. But sometime in the last couple of years, he suddenly got religion, and he suddenly began questioning what he was doing, saying, is this technology really any good, or is it ultimately a force for evil? And so he wrote an essay in Wired magazine, I think about a year and a half ago, with the title, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. The machines are making human beings obsolete, which is a powerful argument. And so that's what I'll be talking about. He's particularly scared of what is called nanotechnology. This is the technology of very, very small machines. So you're supposed to be able to build tiny little machines which will then be able to reproduce themselves and then carry on all the functions of the industrial world and all the things we would like machines to do on this very, very tiny micro scale. And they can organize things themselves. They are so capable, they act like a swarm of ants or a swarm of bees, coordinating their activities and reproducing themselves. And this technology, of course, if it existed, would be very dangerous. Obviously, those creatures really might take over the world, and that's what he's scared of. So the question really is, does that thing exist? Is it a nightmare? Is it purely a figment of the imagination? Or is it something real? Well, it started really about 30 years ago with a young man called Eric Drexler. Eric Drexler was I knew him well as a student. He was a student at MIT, I think. And he got this idea of nanotechnology, and he became a great promoter and preacher, and he founded something called the Foresight Institute to promote this new technology and to warn the world about its dangers. And that became a very hot subject about 30 years ago, and it was considered then to be the wave of the future, and lots of people got excited about it. In my opinion, it has been a flop. In fact, it was a lot of hype. Some real things came out of it, but not very much. And I think you can sort of begin to understand what the problems are if you look at what it really would take to build a self-reproducing machine. That is a machine which can actually construct the parts of which it's built, put them together, get them to function, and recreate itself. What would that really involve? That, in fact, was a question that the mathematician Johnny von Neumann put to himself 50 years ago, and he actually published in 1951, exactly 50 years ago, the answer to that question. This is von Neumann discussing the question of self-reproducing machines, what von Neumann called automata, which means the same thing. And what von Neumann proved by pure mathematics and just by logical considerations is that to have a self-reproducing machine, it has to have four essential components, sort of four components which are logically necessary. And those component A is the factory, which actually produces the parts and is the hardware of this system. And then you have to have the blueprint, that's component B, the blueprint which describes what it is that the factory has to do, what kind of machinery it has to produce. So it's essentially a description of itself. Then you have to have the controller, which is the organizing machinery that organizes that's the wrong order. I might as well stick to von Neumann's order. The third component is the print shop, which reproduces the blueprints. You've got to make a copy of the blueprints to give to the reproduced machine. And the fourth component is the controller, which controls the operations of A, B, and C. It takes the blueprints, it gives the blueprints to the copying machine, it takes the copy of the blueprints, and it feeds the blueprints into the manufacturing machine, so the manufacturing machine follows the instructions and produces more manufacturing machine. And then it finally organizes the whole thing and puts it together, and there you have the second daughter machine. So the component D is the controller, which supervises the organization of A, B, and C. So those four components are logically necessary. Well, now you have to think, how would you actually do all that? And the answer to that actually was found quite soon after von Neumann did that theoretical analysis. In 1953, that was only 2 years later, Watson and Crick discovered the double helix, which of course is the blueprint for a living cell. And it became clear after one had discovered the double helix that in fact every living cell has precisely these four components. That's exactly how life operates. We are, after all, we are self-reproducing machines ourselves. And every cell in our body is a self-reproducing machine. And so those four components are all there. There is the DNA, which is, of course, component C, that is the blueprint. No, that's component B. The copying machine is the polymerase enzyme, the enzyme which runs along the DNA and makes a copy as it goes along. The component A, the hardware, the manufacturing machine, is the ribosome, which in living cells, takes hold of the blueprint, which is the DNA, and converts it into RNA, and then the ribosome converts this RNA then into proteins. And the proteins then are the machinery which carries on the operations of the cell. And then finally, the control system in the living cell is the collection of genes and enzymes which organizes the duplication of the cell. The duplication of the cell, of course, is a complicated process, which is organized carefully and quite precisely by these additional proteins, which are also coded in the DNA. And if you think what it would take to make a self-reproducing machine, that's what you have to do. And I think if we ever got to the point of building such a thing, what we've done is actually reinvent the bacterium. That's all we would have done. Something nature found out how to do 2 or 3 billion years earlier. So I would say that if you take the last 30 years, that biotechnology has actually won the race. That 30 years ago, nanotechnology and biotechnology were about even. Both of them were just at the starting line, and both of them were beginning to produce interesting results. But in the last 30 years, biotechnology has just raced ahead so fast, nanotechnology is left totally behind. It hasn't really done anything, while biotechnology, of course, has been doing all kinds of good and bad things with great success. Anyway, so that's basically the argument, that in my opinion, that the worry about self-reproducing machines and other products of nanotechnology is exaggerated But on the other hand, the dangers are real. But the dangers, of course, are not different from what we already had with biotechnology. So that instead of saying there's a whole lot of new dangers, we should pay more attention to the old dangers, which we are moderately familiar with, particularly, of course, biological weapons. Now we're all scared of having anthrax packaged in the mail and sent to us. And anthrax bombs are a very old story. Aldous Huxley, in 1929, wrote a book called Brave New World. He already knew about anthrax bombs already then. So and anthrax, of course, has been manufactured as a weapon. And we had, at one time, large stockpiles of anthrax in our own, in Britain and in the United States and in several other countries, and certainly in Russia. Well, I might just give, I don't want to spend the whole time talking about this particular problem, but I might give Bill Joy a chance to speak for himself. This debate, of course, really happened on print before it happened at Davos, because both my son George and I had been exchanging emails with Bill Joy, and so we actually carried the debate on print before we got to Davos at all, and so that's why I remember it better. My memory is already dim of what happened last January, but anyway, so here is Bill Joy himself. It starts with a quote, "As society and the problems that face it become more and more complex and machines become more and more intelligent, people will let machines make more of their decisions for them simply because machine-made decisions will bring better results than man-made ones. Eventually, a stage may be reached at which the decisions necessary to keep the system running will be so complex that human beings will be incapable of making them intelligently. At that stage, the machines will be in control. People won't be able to just turn off the machines because they will be so dependent on them that turning off would amount to suicide." That, by the way, is a quote, not from Bill Gates, but from Theodore Kaczynski, the Unabomber. That's part of the Kaczynski Manifesto. So, which Bill Gates actually uses for his own arguments. And I mean, not Bill Gates, Bill Joy. One shouldn't mix them up. And another thing that Bill Joy is saying, that 21st century technologies, nanotechnology and robotics, are so powerful that they can spawn whole new classes of accidents and abuses. Most dangerously, for the first time, these accidents and abuses are widely within the reach of individuals or small groups. They will not require large facilities or rare raw materials. Knowledge alone will enable the use of them. I think it's no exaggeration to say we are on the cusp of the further perfection of extreme evil, an evil whose possibility spreads well beyond that which weapons of mass destruction bequeath to the nation states, onto a surprising and terrible empowerment of extreme individuals. So that's Bill Joy. I mean, it's an eloquent statement, and certainly one has to take it seriously. So here's my, I don't know, I shouldn't spend all the time on this, but, so here is my son George, which I think he had something quite useful to say about this. "The main thing wrong with Bill Joy's article is the title. We are not being replaced by machines, we are being incorporated into a machine. And it is too big, too different, dare one say alien, and perhaps too intelligent for any one of us to fathom. But the future will need us more than ever. Just as when life formed into metazoan organisms for the first time around, single-celled organisms were incorporated into metazoans, not replaced." To me, Joy's essay and some of the references he cites are too alarmist about some things and not alarmist enough about others. I do not believe we are ever going to see human-level artificial intelligence evolve from present-day computers, or bacteria-level nanorobots running loose. It is the thing suddenly growing at completely non-human level and not yet biological level, where life is taking a giant leap that might be cause for concern. As human individuals, we have custody of two immense stores of information, the contents of our minds and the contents of our DNA. Two recent developments, high bandwidth digital communications and ubiquitous polymerase chain reaction, that's the biological multiplication of DNA in the lab, have enabled digital computers to start writing information to our minds and reading information from our DNA. This communication is becoming increasingly two-way as computers start reading from our minds and writing to our DNA. Turn to the back pages of Science. You will find ads such as custom DNA purified and delivered in 48 hours, $1.20 per base. This is $4.80 per byte, which happens to be exactly the price that random access core memory was in 1959. And we know what happened next. We face two profound questions as a result. Will we remain one species or diverge into many? Will we remain of many minds or merge into one? So that's George. I think that's a very good answer to Bill Joy. He's right to worry, but maybe he's worrying about the wrong things. So what does Bill Joy advocate? What do you do? I mean, suppose you're right, this technology is terribly dangerous. What should we do about it? The particular nightmare that Bill Joy is talking about quite a lot is a thing called gray goo. Gray goo is what happens when these nanorobots, these self-reproducing machines, reproduce themselves so that you have this kind of mud, which is huge, billions and billions of these little self-reproducing machines, which eat human beings or anything else that's alive. So they take over the world by eating up everything that's alive. That's gray goo. Well, anyway, I don't happen to take that seriously, but maybe one should. So here is what Bill Joy is saying. Let's give him a chance to say it. Nanotechnology poses the threat of gray goo, perhaps no more interesting than crabgrass, engineered from materials foreign to the environment, which would outcompete the existing biosphere. In both cases, recall of these menaces would be impossible. A global disaster could occur in weeks. Of course, there's a wonderful science fiction book, of Kurt Vonnegut, Ice Nine. What's the title of that? Cat's Cradle. Yes. Right. That's a similar catastrophe. And the robotic threat is farther out, but as Hans Moravec has suggested, biological species really survive encounters with superior competitors. If we use technology to create robotic intelligences that are superior to ours, they might come to view us as expendable. So then here's what he advocates. This is what I want to end with. What he's saying we should do in response to these dangers to try to control the technology. One, have scientists and technologists, and corporate leaders as well, take a vow along the lines of the Hippocratic Oath to avoid work on potential and actual weapons of mass destruction. Hans Bethe, a Nobel laureate, has called for such a step, for not to build nuclear weapons, which I think is a very good move. Use stricter notions of liability, forcing companies to take responsibility for the consequences through a private sector mechanism, insurance. A company might use the published opinion of a new, perhaps international and non-governmental Office of Technology Assessment to argue for lower insurance rates. 4, international control of knowledge and technologies that have great potential but are judged too dangerous to be made commercially available. 5, relinquish pursuit of that knowledge and development of those technologies so dangerous that we judge it better that they never be available. I too believe in the pursuit of knowledge and development of technologies. Yet, as we have seen in cases such as biological weapons, relinquishment is the obvious wise choice. The problem with all that is, of course, who is to decide? Who is to decide what's allowed and what's forbidden? And that's always what you come back to. And I think in this connection, it's interesting to go back to John Milton, who dealt with this problem in the 17th century. You know, John Milton wrote a speech which was called Areopagitica, which I always like to quote in this connection, that he was talking about the freedom of the press. Of course, writing in the middle of the 17th century, I think the date of this was 1644, so that the 30 Years' War was still raging in Germany, which was a war of religion where the whole population of Europe was being massacred and people were killing each other, arguing about books. And of course, England had just been through the devastating civil war, which was also, in many respects, a religious war. So books could kill people. Books were deadly dangerous. So here is Milton talking to the British Parliament in 1644. I deny not, but that it is of greatest concernment in the Church and Commonwealth to have a vigilant eye how books demean themselves as well as men, and therefore to confine in prison and do sharpest justice on them as malefactors. I know they are as lively and as vigorously productive as those fabulous dragon's teeth, and being sown up and down may chance to spring up armed men. But the important word, and this is now me speaking, the important word in Milton's statement is thereafter. Books should not be convicted and imprisoned until after they have done some damage. What Milton objected to was prior censorship, that books would be prohibited even from seeing the light of day. And next, Milton comes to the heart of the matter, the difficulty of regulating things uncertainly and yet equally working to good and to evil. Suppose we could expel sin by this means. Look how much we thus expel of sin, so much we expel of virtue, for the matter of them both is the same. Remove that, and you remove them both alike. This justifies the high providence of God, who, though he commands us temperance, justice, continence, yet pours out before us, even to a profuseness, all desirable things, and gives us minds that can wander beyond all limit and satiety. Why should we then affect a rigor contrary to the manner of God and of nature by abridging or scanting those means which books freely permitted are, both to the trial of virtue and to the exercise of truth? It would be better done to learn that the law must needs be frivolous, which goes to restrain things uncertainly and yet equally working to good and to evil. So I'm saying that technology is the same, that it's a mixture of good and evil. There's no way to separate them. And Who is to do the separation? And that Milton has something very eloquent to say about that. I won't take the time, but he's saying, who are these licensors? Who are these people who are going to sit reading books all day long, deciding what should be printed and what shouldn't be printed? That the job of being a licensor is so deadly boring, you wouldn't get anybody with any real sense to do it. So it ends up being in the hands of bureaucrats. And that's, of course, equally... That's, of course, equally true of science and technology, that, you, or even worse, it goes into the hands of lawyers. So that's where I stand. Anyway, I think that's enough about Bill Joy. It was a very interesting discussion, and I'd like to leave time for questions so we can discuss it ourselves. And I'll go more quickly over the second two debates, and so many other things were interesting in Davos. The second debate was Carl Gerassi, who is the inventor of the birth control pill, and he has spent his life fighting for the right of women not to reproduce. That's his big campaign, and he's still fighting, of course. But he put this technological device, the birth control pill, into the world and made it available. And, of course, it has changed the world. And now he's, 30 years later, or 40 years later, he's got interested in the other side of the question. Well, how about the right of human beings to reproduce? Is that, in fact, a human right which should always be respected? Should people always be allowed to reproduce as they wish? That's, of course, a very hot issue in China. And so we had this debate. It was a little bit artificial because we're really both on the same side, but still it was interesting. And so he was saying that let's just try to quote him accurately. He was simply saying that the control of human reproduction was really a tremendous threat to human freedom, and that we must fight for that just as much as we must fight for the freedom not to reproduce. That's essentially what he was saying. The right to have babies should be a fundamental right, and we should really challenge the Chinese view of things and try and get them to change their minds. Well, I was then arguing, of course, that... Well, the problem is serious, but the answer is not simple. And although there are not just two interests at stake, there are really four interests at stake. There's the father, the mother, the child, and the community. And all four have their different interests. And of course, the rights can conflict in various ways, and you have to adjudicate who should have the power to decide. So if it's a fight between the father and the mother, of course it's really quite simple that one wants to have a baby and the other doesn't. Well, you should wait until you can come to an agreement, and that's fairly clear. The more interesting case is where you say the mother wants to have a child, but it's clearly not in the interest of the child. There's a good, an example of that in my own family. I have a daughter who is a medical doctor, and she was talking about one of her patients, and I shouldn't be too specific about that. You're not supposed to talk about your patients. But anyway, one of her patients was a young woman who came in because she had heart problems as a result of being a drug addict. And so she has, first of all, a drug addiction, secondly, serious heart problems. And she's just pregnant with her fifth child. And so my daughter was trying to talk her out of it and saying, well... don't you think it's not such a good idea to bring this fifth child into the world? And anyway, the girl said, well, you know, my mum will take care of it. My mum took care of the other four, so she could take care of this one. Anyway, so in that case, should the interest of the mother or the interest of the child prevail? It's a hard question. And in fact, in that case, the mother prevailed. And But the most, of course, the real problem is the one that Gerassi is talking about, which is the family against the community. That's the situation in China. And here, of course, it's a problem of the culture, that it's the American individualistic morality against the Chinese traditional community morality, that in China, all through history, the community decides and the individual goes along. And that's a very, very strong part of the culture. And it has its virtues. And in America, the individual is supposed to be on top, and to hell with the community. And so it's a question. I think we just have to coexist. I think both kinds of morality make sense. Both of them are appropriate to the particular communities that they serve. And we should learn to live together and tolerate each other. So I think it's fundamentally misguided for somebody like Carl Gerassi, admirable though he may be, to try to tell the Chinese how to behave. I think that's an American vice, telling the rest of the world how to behave. And even quite good people sometimes indulge in it. And so that's Carl Gerassi. And well, the third one is Brian Greene, who is a great scientist, a very fine scientist. He's an expert on string theory, which is the most esoteric part of physics, which is trying to go to the very, very deepest level of the physical world and describe it in terms of beautiful mathematics. So everybody agrees that it's beautiful mathematics. People don't necessarily agree that it has anything to do with reality. But anyhow, Brian Greene, in addition to being a first-rate scientist, he also writes beautiful prose, and he wrote a book called The Elegant Universe, describing his view of the universe, which I recommend. It's an excellent book. And and he writes, of course, much more moderately than he was debating in this particular debate. And anyhow, so his subject was, when will we know it all? And he was taking the view that we will know it all pretty fast. And he says, this generation is amazingly lucky. We'll probably discover the fundamental laws of nature, just a set of equations that describes it all. And everything else follows then from those equations. And once we have the fundamental equations, we are done. That's the end. And no more fundamental problems left. All that's left is just to apply the fundamental problems to practical concerns. And well, that's a job you leave then to the technicians. And if we're not smart enough, our grandchildren will finish the job. And either way, sort of the end of science is coming close. Well, that's, of course, what the philosophers call reductionism, the idea that the whole of human knowledge and of human science in particular can be reduced essentially to physics or to a finite set of equations you can write down on a piece of paper. It's a marvelous fact, of course, which is the thing that Brian Greene is, he's not talking nonsense. He's only just going slightly beyond what's reasonable, but it is an amazing fact that the fundamental laws of nature are simple and beautiful. That is an astonishing thing, that you don't need to do all sorts of experiments to discover the laws of nature. It really does. It's really not necessary. You guess the laws by looking for mathematical simplicity and beauty. And then a few experiments decide whether you guessed right. And that's, of course, it happened many times in the history of science, that Newton's laws of motion were a great example. I mean, Newton just wrote down these simple laws, and it explained the whole of classical science, essentially, and including astronomy. And, then Maxwell equations came along. They explain electromagnetism, and into the bargain, explained light. Then, of course, the greatest of all was Einstein writing down his laws of relativity and gravitation. Schrödinger writing down, his Schrödinger equation. And all of them were just beautiful, simple, elegant mathematics. And to our amazement, nature danced to the same tune, that you checked the numbers that came out of the experiments, and they agree with the theory. It's a magic. We don't understand why, but they do. So that's what inspires Brian Greene, that nature has this marvelous simplicity. So things do, in a sense, they do reduce to something simple and beautiful. But of course, on the other side, now I'm arguing the other side, theoretical physics isn't the whole of science. It's not even the whole of physics. And these, all these other sciences, chemistry, biology, psychology, they can't really be reduced to physics. It's just not so. They have their own concepts, their own ways of thinking. And just knowing the equations doesn't really help you. It helps, but it doesn't allow you to imagine what nature can do with those equations. And one simple example of that is the black hole, which is a consequence of Einstein's equations of gravitation. The black hole is an unbelievably exotic and beautiful thing. It's a place where space-time goes completely haywire, and space turns into time, and time turns into space, and the geometry is all crooked. And the black hole is just an extreme example of what Einstein's equations can do. But Einstein himself wasn't interested in that. He didn't believe in black holes. He wasn't even interested to find out whether they existed. He thought that was just, it was boring to him. It wasn't interesting. It wasn't fundamental. He had the equations. That was all that mattered. And I would say Einstein actually didn't understand gravity. He only understood his equations. Until you understand the solutions of the equations, you don't really understand the equations. And so he had a very partial view. And that's even more true, of course, when you come to biology, that you can reduce a living creature to a set of molecules. And, it's like reducing a symphony to a set of dots on a CD. Well, the dots on the CD actually, of course, tell you everything about the symphony except how it sounds. And of course, the molecular analysis of a living creature tells you everything about the creature except how it lives. And so the fact is that science is not reductive, it's also, and it goes both ways. So as well as reduction, we also engage in construction. And to my mind, that is just as beautiful, just as fundamental. Well, there's also a sort of philosophical aspect to this, that we know that there is a tremendous discovery which came as a big shock to the mathematicians. In 1931, Gödel, the great mathematician, proved that mathematics is inexhaustible, that he proved by mathematics that there are mathematical statements that are perfectly meaningful, perfectly well-defined, which cannot either be proved or disproved using any finite system of axioms. So that if you have any sort of mathematical scheme, like geometry and trigonometry or calculus, any of our existing mathematics, you can find statements that you cannot either prove or disprove. You can't tell from those assumptions whether the statement's true or untrue. So you can always, no matter how far you go in mathematics, you can always find new questions that you can't settle using the existing principles. So mathematics is inexhaustible. And that's, of course, very happy. To my mind, that's just one example of how lucky we are that mathematics will never be finished. And that, of course, extends to physics and chemistry and biology and everything, because they're all in some way mixed up with mathematics. So if mathematics is inexhaustible, then all these other things are inexhaustible too. So we are, I think, we're not in danger that science is coming to an end. Mathematics has its open frontier guaranteed by Gödel. And then in addition, of course, the complexity frontier, which is the frontier of more and more complex structures, is guaranteed by existence of molecules, cells, animals, living creatures like us, and human societies. And of course, last but not least, there's the geographical frontier, the fact that we live in a universe which is expanding infinitely in space and time, so there will always be new worlds to explore just because we live in this great, grand, expanding universe. So that's it. Have I run out of time? What's the time?
It's a good time to begin questions.
Good, excellent.
Please don't run away. I plan to take Freeman now to lecture room 6 for 2 questions. It'll be 5 to 10 minutes, and then we'll be back here. If we are in control of technology, you will even hear the questions. And so we will go to lecture room number 6 and be back here shortly. Please think of good, intelligent questions in the meantime.
And they don't have to be about the talk. You can ask questions about anything you like.
Yes. We've brought Freeman here. Unfortunately, we have only a few minutes, but I thought you should see him. And I'll have trouble. I'll get into trouble by deciding which 2 questions we take here. But who wants to start? Okay, here.
A wealthy and complex society becomes rather like a large and complex organism. It's kind of a growth medium for pathogens in the case of a body, or I suppose Harris in the case of a complex society. What our bodies have is an immune system that recognizes things that are trying to take advantage of us. And I think you were beginning to allude to thoughts that you or others had about what a society might do about the power of an individual in a complex society to do a lot of damage.
Right.
Repeat the question.
Yes, so the question is, what should sort of countermeasures should we envisage when individuals are empowered to do such tremendous damage to when our societies become so vulnerable to the harm that an individual or a small group can do? And of course, I mean, I deliberately avoided talking about the recent events in the speech, but of course I'm perfectly happy to talk about it now in questions. And obviously we all have that in our minds. What should we do? And I believe in civil defense. One of my happiest memories is of the days in 1939 when our much maligned Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain — I was then in England as a kid — our Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, with amazing efficiency and I think with vision, manufactured 50 million gas masks and supplied every man, woman, and child in England with a gas mask. And so I carried my gas mask to school every day. That was, And it made us feel good. We knew we were up against this monster, Hitler. We knew that we'll probably be dealing with anthrax and other such horrors. And of course, gas masks actually are better against anthrax than they are against gas. And they would have given us pretty good protection against anthrax, not so good against nerve gases. But anyhow, we were happy having these gas masks. And I think it was extremely important that we had this kind of civil defense mentality, that we could defend ourselves, that we weren't just at the mercy of these people. And it also, I think, discouraged Hitler from using the stuff in the first place, which also helped. And so I believe in civil defense. It's unfortunate the United States doesn't. I mean, civil defense is sort of a bad word in the United States. But for me, having grown up in England, I love it. And of course, there are other things you can do besides gas masks. But basically, that's what you have to do. Against biological weapons, positive pressure in buildings is very effective. All you need, if you have positive air pressure in a building with a filtered intake, and you're safe inside, so anybody who can get indoors into such a building is safe. That makes a huge difference. Most of us spend our lives indoors most of the time. So if you just took somewhat simple physical measures against biological attacks, you probably can do pretty well. And of course, biological attacks are so chancy anyway that a little bit of precaution could make a huge difference.
Second question.
Yes. Here.
To every complex question, there is a simple answer, and it's wrong. But I turn that on you. By my trade, I'm an engineer. I have to live with people like you.
No, this is all great fun, but I think we should come to the question, if you don't mind.
Repeat. Is there a question? It's a comment, really.
It's just a comment.
Right.
Okay.
Do you want to comment on the? Do you want to repeat?
No,
the
I think I think I can't repeat it. I think but so let's have a question.
Yes. Over to Doug.
So the question is, do I think it reasonable that the whole of the laws of physics could be understood, that the basic laws of nature, insofar as they're physical, could be understood within one generation? And the answer is, I don't know. I mean, it could happen. I hope not. I would consider it very disappointing. I would feel the creator had somehow been lacking in imagination, if that's true. But it could happen, of course. I mean, he doesn't always agree with me.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to take him back into the other room.
Well, thank you for waiting.
And you've had time now to think about questions. Who wants to start? Here.
Can I ask you a physics question?
Yes.
But make it short.
So I'm afraid those aren't questions that I can answer. I mean, the word fundamental isn't really a sort of a scientific word. I think I'll pass on that one. And
back there.
But could we have the question?
Do you agree with them? And if so, what areas do you think have some future amongst the current research programs underway in the world today?
Well, I don't... I don't agree with what you said about either Feynman or Dirac, of course. I mean, I knew them both, and they both were fundamentally happy, well-adjusted people. And
and besides, you're not at the end of your life.
Not yet, no. But I don't know. I don't know what to say about that. Let's have another one. Yes, that's a good question. The question is... that people speak about science as a new religion. Would I like to comment on that? And it is true. I mean, Einstein himself was that rather of that way of thinking. He thought of science as something sacred, and he said that he couldn't imagine anybody being a good scientist who didn't share his faith. And of course, I find that profoundly mistaken, that there are, in fact, a great many excellent scientists who don't share that kind of mystical view of science at all. They regard science as a skilled trade that they enjoy. It's a way of making a living. It's all kinds of things to different people. It doesn't have to be practiced in a religious frame of mind. And I think it does harm to look at science from that point of view. It puts science onto a pedestal where it shouldn't be. Science is just one of our faculties and by no means the most important. And it's great fun to do. It's rather, I mean, similar to other skilled trades. And I would like to keep it separated from religion. Religion is important in a different way. I regard them as two windows for looking on the universe, and they're equally valid but you can't look through both windows at the same time. And I think the confusion of trying to make science into a religion is just about as damaging as trying to make religion into a science, which of course is the fault of the creationists. And,
In view of this response, it is wonderful that we live in a world in which Freeman recently won the Templeton Prize for Science and Religion.
Yes, well, so do I. I mean, that's not, but there's no reason why a scientist shouldn't, but lots of them don't. And lots of them, in fact, sort of consider God to be their personal enemy.
Other questions?
Yes.
Yes?
Can science give an alternative to war?
Can science give us an alternative to war? I don't think so. Science is a tool. that you can use for war or you can use it for peace, but by itself it can't make peace. Peace has to come from, peace is a human problem. Science can help, of course. I think science, one of the best things science can do is simply by creating an international community of people who can talk to each other. That has been very helpful. It was helpful particularly between the Western world and the Soviet Union. The scientists in the Soviet Union could talk to the scientists in the Western world when the politicians totally failed. And that was, in fact, quite important. The dissolution of the Soviet Union, I think, had quite a lot to do with the fact that the Soviet scientific community was thoroughly alienated. And that has been a little bit true between India and Pakistan today, that the scientists are talking to each other, even though the rest of the two countries are otherwise so alienated. So we can, but that's not because we know how to make bombs. It's simply because we understand how to talk to each other.
Way back there, loud and short.
Oh, I usually be pretty loud, really short.
Well, that's, of course, a technical question, whether nuclear technology could be helpful in diverting asteroids from colliding with the Earth. And there are better ways of doing it. I've actually studied this quite, and it's an interesting problem. What you need for diverting an asteroid, if you see an asteroid that's coming to collide with the Earth, what you need is a long warning time. That's the most important thing, to have... So the first requirement is to have good telescopes and radars to detect all the stuff out there, so you have a sufficiently long warning time. And then the next thing you need is a slow, steady push, not a huge explosion. An explosion, in fact, is a very inefficient way of pushing at something. By far more efficient is to have a slow, steady push. So the best way of doing this, actually, is to have a thing called a mass driver, which is a machine which is driven by solar energy and will simply pick up soil from the surface of the asteroid, throw it off into space steadily, and continue for as long a time as you have available. And that gives you lots of momentum with a small amount of energy, and so that you can easily calculate that for an object which is the size of the Tunguska object which exploded over Siberia, which is a typical example of a dangerous object which might have killed millions of people. Fortunately, it only exploded over an uninhabited region in Siberia. You can calculate that what it would have taken to divert that object from hitting the Earth would have been 10 kilowatts of sunlight for 1 year. That's all it would have taken. So it's much better than a hydrogen bomb for that particular job.
Yes. Here.
Yes.
Do you think
Should governments fund research for human cloning? Well, at the present time, obviously the answer is no. First of all, the science hasn't yet been done. We don't yet understand what makes cloning work. Ian Wilmot, this delightful Scotsman who discovered how to clone sheep. He's an animal breeder, really, not a scientist. He didn't bother to understand the science. He just went ahead and did it. But we have to understand, if we want to apply it to humans, we have to understand the science. You want to know how to do it safely, how to do it without damaging the child that you're producing. So I certainly wouldn't advocate funding for that, and I don't think any government in its right mind would want to do it at the present time. But the fact of the matter is that the pressure for this kind of intervention does not come from governments, it comes from parents. There's a very good book which I recommend on this subject called Remaking Eden by Lee Silver, who is a biologist in Princeton. And it's all about fertility clinics. It's about what goes on when parents want babies, and they're prepared to go to any length to get them. And that's where the push for cloning is going to come, not from governments, but from parents. So the question is, what do you allow and what do you forbid to the parents? And that's a difficult question. And I think it's too soon yet, because we don't know enough to know where to draw the line. And so I think it would be foolish to say we never want to permit parents to produce a baby by cloning. In this book, Remaking Eden, it describes a lot of possible case histories where cloning might make sense. And of course, there are a lot of other situations where it would not make sense. So you have to have rules, and the rules have to be finally in the hands of lawyers. And you have to be prepared to send people to jail if they do the wrong thing. And so you have to have rules that people are actually going to respect. And if you go against the wishes of the parents too much, the rules are not going to be respected and they're not going to be enforced. So we shall see. I think at the present time it's much too soon.
Here and then there.
Well, that's a big subject. It's
what's the subject?
Global warming. And again, I happen to be a heretic, as usual. I disagree with the party line, which sort of regards global warming as sort of one of the most important dangers facing the human species. I don't agree with that. I think, first of all, the warming is not global. It's occurring mostly at high latitudes rather than low latitudes. It's occurring mostly in winter rather than in summer. It's occurring mostly at night rather than in the daytime. So it's sort of... The warming is happening. There's no question the warming is happening, but it's really not global. And it's mostly happening in places where it doesn't do you very much harm. I mean, because you can argue about this, and I don't expect people to agree with me, but at least it's a tenable position, that the warming that is happening is in fact mostly beneficial rather than harmful, and that happens to be my opinion. So I think we have been misled by a lot of propaganda into believing that this is a grave danger. It is a danger, and you have to worry about it. We should be worrying about it. But I would put it number 15 on my list of dangers rather than number one. And I think the problems of nuclear weapons maybe should be number one, and biological weapons number two, and overpopulation number three. There are all sorts of much worse problems. And then after that, then maybe worry about global warming.
But you could be wrong.
I could be easily wrong, yes. That was a big subject at Davos, and that was, I'm happy you asked that question. That was the next thing I would have talked about. Yes. What?
What is the big subject?
The big subject is genetically modified food. And, sorry. Yes. Anyway, so there was a very vigorous debate about that. I wasn't a speaker, I was a bystander. And the interesting thing was the main protagonists there were Europeans against genetically modified food, Africans in favor of it, and the Africans definitely want it. They are in possession of a continent where agriculture is very difficult. Unlike the Europeans, of course, are in possession of a continent where agriculture is much easier. And so the Europeans want to protect the agricultural communities that they already have, so they don't want all these innovations. But the Africans do. They have a lousy climate over most of Africa, bad soils, not enough rain, and for all sorts of reasons, it's very hard to sustain agriculture over much of Africa. Either it's too dry or too wet, depending on where you are. And so the Africans were very vocal, and they said, first of all, we can do it ourselves. We don't need to be told how to do it. We can do it ourselves. And we will, and they want to have genetically modified foods to grow crops which have higher yields and are resistant to insects and pests, which are very severe in Africa. And they say, what is more, we want to export. We want to be able to export our products to Europe as well as to feed ourselves. So they resent the Europeans for excluding genetically modified foods. So I was very happy to hear that. Of course, I was on the side of the Africans. And of course, there are strong views about this also all over the world. By and large, I think Latin America is mostly on the side of the Africans, and I don't know, and India and China, of course, are likely to be on the side of the Africans too. Yes?
Back there.
So would the debate be different if one was speaking about human feelings and understanding rather than about science? I think that's what we were speaking about. I think the debates weren't really about science. They were about human problems arising out of science. That's what they are, and that's why opinions can be different. If it was only about science, we probably would agree.
Yes. More questions? There, yes. And then there.
So do I think what could be used?
Cryptography.
Yes. The question was, should cryptography be used to regulate digital technology? Yes, the answer is yes. I mean, cryptography, of course, is being used essentially to evade regulation, and that, I think, is good. I'm on the whole libertarian, would like to have people should be free to communicate privately, which is what cryptography allows you to do. So I think cryptography on the whole is good. Of course, it can be put to bad uses like everything else. It can be used by terrorists to communicate with one another. And it is presumably being used by them. But I think that's the price you should pay. And if you try to restrict cryptography, it doesn't work because it's out there anyhow. And the bad guys already have it. So if you try to restrict it, you're probably hampering the good guys more than the bad guys. Yes?
Would you comment on the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, especially its prior restraint aspects?
The question was, would I comment on the Digital Millennium Act and on its prior restraint of technology? I don't know what it says. I better not comment. Good. So I don't know if any of you, or all of you, heard that. I don't have much to say about it because I don't know the facts. I think if what you say is true, then obviously I agree with you. I'd like to look at the documents and see what really happened before sort of making up my own mind.
Robert?
So what do I see as the role of religion in the coming decades in relation to science? Well, I don't see religion as having any particular connection with science. My religion is quite separate from my science. I consider them both to be very important and valuable, and I hope people will learn to keep them separate. That's, to my mind, the key to peaceful coexistence. What they should be doing is to combine forces to fight for good causes, and in particular, of course, for the alleviation of extreme poverty, for peace, for the for goodwill among nations, and all those good causes in which religion and science can work together, we should work together. And I think to some extent that's likely to happen. I wish it would happen much more and much quicker.
We have two more questions from the back of the room. One there, and then one there.
Professor Dyson, what is your current thinking on human entry into space?
So what's my thinking about human entry into space? I am very much a believer in humans going into space in the long run, but it has to be the long run because it has to get cheap first. I'm not interested in spending billions and billions of dollars for a big show on television, which everybody can just enjoy by sitting in front of the tube. And it should not be a spectator sport. It should be a sport in which ordinary citizens, if they feel like it, can engage. And so it means bringing down the costs by something like a factor of 100 before I become really interested. I think that probably will happen. And I should mention in this connection a thing called the light craft, which was invented by a gentleman called Lech Mirabeau at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in New York State. He has invented this little toy, which is a laser-propelled spacecraft, which up till now it has flown only to a height of about 200 feet. It flies up a laser beam, using the laser beam as its source of power, and it weighs about 2 ounces. And it looks very fine. I've seen a film of it flying, and it's a beautiful toy. But if you imagine this multiplied by 100,000, it could be a space launch system, a laser beam which sits on top of a mountain and just makes a public highway into space. And you come along there with your little spacecraft. You sit on top of the laser. Up you go, and you pay the toll and up you go. It could, in principle, be very cheap. It would be like a public highway, that it only becomes cheap when lots of people use it. So you want to launch every 5 minutes, all day long, 24 hours a day. If you can do that,
okay.
So, anyway, that I would say what we saw on this film of the light craft was sort of the equivalent of the flight of the Wright brothers in the year 1903, or from the Wright brothers to commercial airlines flying across oceans, only took 50 years. So I think there's a chance in 50 years one will have that kind of an expansion in space travel.
You clearly now understand the kind of question that sends Freeman off into outer space. We're going to have the last scintillating question from the back.
Dr. Dyson, in your discussions with Carl Jurassic, the man who gave the right of freedom of choice to women 40 years ago, did it occur to you to ask him why 40 years later the right to choose men still not been developed in the birth control bill?
Yes, he talked about that, not in Davos, but on other occasions. Yes, he is very much concerned about that too. I mean, the problem is, of course, the amount of money it requires just to develop any drug, and particularly one that's not for curing a deadly disease. The requirements for the clinical testing are so severe that it takes not only huge amounts of money, but a very long time to develop any new drugs. And that's, of course, it's a big question, whether that, in fact, is doing more harm than good. He would like to shorten the process of development of drugs with this particular application in mind.
We could go on for a long time. The room is full of questions. But those... No, you've had a question. Sorry. No, just a minute. So for those people who feel they have to engage the Dyson family with questions and other things, come here on February 9th when George Dyson will give a lecture in this room. In the meantime, I will ask Professor Bill Unruh to thank our speaker.
Well, let me thank you for good questions.
When I was a graduate student in Princeton in the 1970s, One of the most remarkable features about that place was the atmosphere there. It was a very unusual combination of willingness to listen and to learn and respect others, and a tolerance indeed and almost a reveling in what some would sometimes call crazy ideas. But at the same time, an insistence on subjecting all those ideas to deep and rigorous thought and analysis. This atmosphere, I've come to realize, is unusual in the competitive arena that physics very often is. It's also an atmosphere that can only be inculcated by example. And one of the people that provided that example at Princeton was Freeman Dyson. I've long had a very deep affection for him. It's not only because it was a question from him that produced one of the papers that I think is one of my most fun papers. But I remember also in the 1980s, I was reading two autobiographies of physicists who had played such a crucial role in the development of quantum field theory, Richard Feynman and Freeman Dyson, in his book, Disturbing the Universe. And one of the things that struck me there was the contrast between the two, one person hiding behind a mask, and the other struggling with the contradictions and passions that are his life. And that example has stayed with me since I've read those books. We've heard again tonight someone who takes both the world as it is, with all its mess of contradictions and hopes, and also takes ideas, even if they sometimes sound like wild ideas, seriously. Thank you, Freeman.
Thank you, Bill. Freeman will sign books for a few minutes upstairs. Also, it's a time when you can actually renew your commitment to the Vancouver Institute and then come back next Saturday when Professor John Hepburn of UBC Department of Chemistry will speak on Terra Incognita, a pathfinding